word as to where he was staying. I confirmed my address there, and the servant said she would let him know if he called. Madame was not well and was still sleeping. I called all the name hotels and left messages, but could not locate Scott, and then I went out to a cafe to have an aperitif and read the papers. At the cafe, I met a man who ate fire for a living and also bent coins which he held in his toothless jaws with his thumb and forefinger. His gums were sore but firm to the eye as he exhibited them, and he said it was not a bad métier. I asked him to have a drink, and he was pleased. He had a fine dark face that glowed and shone when he ate the fire. He said there was no money in eating fire, nor in feats of strength with fingers and jaws in Lyon. False fire-eaters had ruined the métier and would continue to ruin it wherever they were allowed to practice. He had been eating fire all evening, he said, and did not have enough money on him to eat anything else that night. I asked him to have another drink, to wash away the petrol taste of the fire-eating, and said we could have dinner together if he knew a good place that was cheap enough. He said he knew an excellent place. We ate very cheaply in an Algerian restaurant, and I liked the food and the Algerian wine. The fire-eater was a nice man, and it was interesting to see him eat, as he could chew with his gums as well as most people can with their teeth. He asked me what I did to make a living, and I told him that I was starting in as a writer. He asked what sort of writing, and I told him stories. He said he knew many stories, some of them more horrible and incredible than anything that had ever been written. He could tell them to me, and I would write them, and then if they made any money, I would give him whatever I thought fair. Better still, we could go to North Africa together, and he would take me to the country of the Blue Sultan, where I could get stories such as no man had ever heard. I asked him what sort of stories, and he said battles, executions, tortures, violations, fearful customs, unbelievable practices, debaucheries, anything I needed. It was getting time for me to get back to the hotel and check on Scott again, so I paid for the meal and said we would certainly be running into each other again. He said he was working down toward Marseille, and I said sooner or later we would meet somewhere, and it was a pleasure to have dined together. I left him straightening out bent coins and stacking them on the table, and walked back to the hotel. Lyon was not a very cheerful town at night. It was a big, heavy, solid money town, probably fine if you had money and liked that sort of town. For years I had heard about the wonderful chicken in the restaurants there, but we had eaten mutton instead. The mutton had been excellent. There was no word from Scott at the hotel, and I went to bed in the unaccustomed luxury of the hotel and read a copy of the first volume of A Sportsman's Sketches by Turgenev that I had borrowed from Sylvia Beach's library. I had not been in the heavy luxury of a big hotel for 3 years, and I opened the windows wide and rolled up the pillows under my back and head, and was happy being with Turgenev in Russia until I was asleep while still reading. I was shaving in the morning, getting ready to go out for breakfast, when they called from the desk saying a gentleman was downstairs to see me. "Ask him to come up, please," I said, and went on shaving, listening to the town which had come heavily alive since early morning. Scott did not come up, and I met him down at the desk. "I'm terribly sorry there was this mix-up," he said. "If I had only known what hotel you were going to, it would have been simple." "That's all right," I said. We were going to have a long ride, and I was all for peace. "What train did you come down on?" "One not long after the one you took. It was a very comfortable train, and we might just as well have come down together." "Have you had breakfast?" "Not yet. I've been hunting all over the town for you." "That's a shame," I said. "Didn't they tell you at home that I was here?" "No. Zelda wasn't feeling well, and I probably shouldn't have come. The whole trip has been disastrous so far." "Let's get some breakfast and find the car and roll," I said. "That's fine. Should we have breakfast here?" "It would be quicker in a cafe, but we're sure to get a good breakfast here." "All right." It was a big American breakfast with ham and eggs, and it was very good. But by the time we had ordered it, waited for it, eaten it, and waited to pay for it, close to an hour had been lost. It was not until the waiter came with the bill that Scott decided that we have the hotel make us a picnic lunch. I tried to argue him out of this, as I was sure we could get a bottle of Macon in Macon, and we could buy something to make sandwiches in a charcuterie. Or, if things were closed when we went through, there would be any number of restaurants where we could stop on our way. But he said I had told him that the chicken was wonderful in Lyon, and that we should certainly take one with us. So the hotel made us a lunch that could not have cost us very much more than 4 or 5 times what it would have cost us if we had bought it ourselves. Scott had obviously been drinking before I met him, and as he looked as though he needed a drink, I asked him if he did not want one in the bar before we set out. He told me he was not a morning drinker and asked if I was. I told him it depended entirely on how I felt and what I had to do, and he said that if I felt that I needed a drink, he would keep me company so I would not have to drink alone. So we had a whiskey and Perrier in the bar while we waited for the lunch, and both felt much better. I paid for the hotel room and the bar, although Scott wanted to pay for everything. Since the start of the trip, I had felt a little complicated about it emotionally, and found I felt much better the more things I could pay for. I was using up money we had saved for Spain, but I knew I had good credit with Sylvia Beach, and could borrow and repay whatever I was wasting now. At the garage where Scott had left the car, it was astonishing to find that the small Renault had no top. The top had been damaged in unloading the car in Marseille, or it had been damaged in Marseille in some manner. Scott explained it a little vaguely, and Zelda had ordered it cut away and refused to have it replaced. His wife hated car tops, Scott told me, and without the top, they had driven as far as Lyon, where they were halted by the rain. The car was in fair shape otherwise, and Scott paid the bill after disputing several charges for washing, greasing, and for adding 2 liters of oil. The garage man explained to me that the car needed new piston rings, and had evidently been run without sufficient oil and water. He showed me how it had heated up and burned the paint off the motor. He said if I could persuade Monsieur to have a ring job done in Paris, the car, which was a good little car, would be able to give the service it was built for, if it was cared for at all. Monsieur would not let me replace the top. No. One has an obligation to a vehicle. One has. You gentlemen have no waterproofs? No, I said. I did not know about the top. Try and make Monsieur be serious, he said pleadingly. At least about the vehicle. Ah, I said. We were halted by rain about an hour north of Lyon. In that day, we were halted by rain possibly 10 times. They were passing showers, and some of them were longer than others. If we had waterproof coats, it would have been pleasant enough to drive in that spring rain. As it was, we sought the shelter of trees or halted at cafes alongside the road. We had a marvelous lunch from the hotel at Lyon, an excellent truffled roast chicken, delicious bread and white Macon wine, and Scott was very happy when we drank the white Maconnet at each of our stops. At Macon, I had bought 4 more bottles of excellent wine, which I uncorked as we needed them. I am not sure Scott had ever drunk wine from a bottle before, and it was exciting to him, as though he were slumming or as a girl might be excited by going swimming for the first time without a bathing suit. But by early afternoon, he had begun to worry about his health. He told me about 2 people who had died of congestion of the lungs recently. Both of them had died in Italy, and he had been deeply impressed. I told him that congestion of the lungs was an old-fashioned term for pneumonia, and he told me that I knew nothing about it and was absolutely wrong. Congestion of the lungs was a malady which was indigenous to Europe, and I could not possibly know anything about it, even if I had read my father's medical books, since they dealt with diseases that were strictly American. I said that my father had studied in Europe, too. But Scott explained that congestion of the lungs had only appeared in Europe recently, and that my father could not possibly have known anything about it. He also explained that diseases were different in different parts of America, and if my father had practiced medicine in New York instead of in the Middle West, he would have known an entirely different gamut of diseases. He used the word gamut. I said that he had a good point in the prevalence of certain diseases in one part of the United States and their absence in others, and cited the amount of leprosy in New Orleans and its low incidence then in Chicago. But I said that doctors had a system of exchange of knowledge and information among themselves, and now that I remembered it, after he had brought it up, I had read the authoritative article on congestion of the lungs in Europe in the Journal of the American Medical Association, which traced its history back to Hippocrates himself. This held him for a while, and I urged him to take another drink of Macon, since a good white wine, moderately full-bodied but with a low alcoholic content, was almost a specific against the disease. Scott cheered a little after this, but he began to fail again shortly, and asked me if we would make a big town before the onset of the fever and delirium by which, I had told him, the true congestion of the lungs, European, announced itself. I was now translating from an article which I had read in a French medical journal on the same malady while waiting at the American hospital in Neuilly to have my throat cauterized, I told him. A word like cauterized had a comforting effect on Scott, but he wanted to know when we would make the town. I said if we pushed on, we should make it in 25 minutes to an hour. Scott then asked me if I were afraid to die, and I said more at some times than at others. It now began to rain really heavily, and we took refuge in the next village at a cafe. I cannot remember all the details of that afternoon, but when we were finally in a hotel at what must have been Chalon-sur-Saône, it was so late that the drugstores were closed. Scott had undressed and gone to bed as soon as we reached the hotel. He did not mind dying of congestion of the lungs, he said. It was only the question of who was to look after Zelda and young Scotty. I did not see very well how I could look after them, since I was having a healthily rough time looking after my wife Hadley and young son Bumby, but I said I would do my best, and Scott thanked me. I must see that Zelda did not drink, and that Scotty should have an English governess. We had sent our clothes to be dried and were in our pajamas. It was still raining outside, but it was cheerful in the room with the electric light on. Scott was lying in bed to conserve his strength for his battle against the disease. I had taken his pulse, which was 72, and had felt his forehead, which was cool. I had listened to his chest and had him breathe deeply, and his chest sounded all right. "Look, Scott," I said, "you're perfectly okay. If you want to do the best thing to keep from catching cold, just stay in bed, and I'll order us each a lemonade and a whiskey. And you take an aspirin with yours, and you'll feel fine, and won't even get a cold in your head." "Those old wives' remedies," Scott said. "You haven't any temperature. How the hell are you going to have congestion of the lungs without a temperature?" "Don't swear at me," Scott said. "How do you know I haven't a temperature? Your pulse is normal, and you haven't any fever to the touch." "To the touch," Scott said bitterly. "If you're a real friend, get me a thermometer." "I'm in pajamas."
"Send for one."
I rang for the waiter. He didn't come, and I rang again and then went down the hallway to look for him. Scott was lying with his eyes closed, breathing slowly and carefully, and with his waxy color and his perfect features, he looked like a little dead crusader. I was getting tired of the literary life, if this was the literary life that I was leading, and already I missed not working, and I felt the death loneliness that comes at the end of every day that is wasted in your life. I was very tired of Scott and of this silly comedy, but I found the waiter and gave him money to buy a thermometer and a tube of aspirin, and ordered 2 citron pressés and 2 double whiskies. I tried to order a bottle of whiskey, but they would only sell it by the drink. Back in the room, Scott was still lying as though on his tomb, sculpted as a monument to himself, his eyes closed and breathing with exemplary dignity. Hearing me come in the room, he spoke.
"Did you get the thermometer?"
I went over and put my hand on his forehead. It was not as cold as the tomb, but it was cool and not clammy. "Nope," I said.
"I thought you'd brought it.
I sent out for it."
"It's not the same thing."
"No, it isn't, is it?" You could not be angry with Scott any more than you could be angry with someone who was crazy. But I was getting angry with myself for having become involved in the whole silliness. He did have a point, though, and I knew it very well. Most drunkards in those days died of pneumonia, a disease which has now been almost eliminated. But it was hard to accept him as a drunkard, since he was affected by such small quantities of alcohol. In Europe, then, we thought of wine as something as healthy and normal as food, and also as a great giver of happiness and well-being and delight. Drinking wine was not a snobism, nor a sign of sophistication, nor a cult. It was as natural as eating, and to me as necessary. And I would not have thought of eating a meal without drinking either wine or cider or beer. I loved all wines except sweet or Swedish wines and wines that were too heavy. And it had never occurred to me that sharing a few bottles of fairly light, dry, white Macon could cause chemical changes in Scott that would turn him into a fool. There had been the whiskey in Perrier in the morning, but in my ignorance of alcoholics then, I could not imagine that harming anyone who was driving in an open car in the rain. The alcohol should have been oxidized in a very short time. While waiting for the waiter to bring the various things, I sat and read a paper and finished one of the bottles of Macon that had been uncorked at the last stop. When you live in France, there are always some splendid crimes in the newspapers that you follow from day to day. These crimes read like continued stories, and it is necessary to have read the opening chapters, since there are no summaries provided as there are in American serial stories, and anyway, no serial is as good in an American periodical unless you have read the all-important first chapter. When you are traveling through France, the papers are disappointing because you miss the continuity of the different crime, affair, or scandale, and you miss much of the pleasure to be derived from reading about them in a café. Tonight, I would have much preferred to be in a café where I might read the morning editions of the Paris papers and watch the people and drink something a little more authoritative than the Macon in preparation for dinner. But I was riding herd on Scott, so I enjoyed myself where I was. When the waiter arrived with the two glasses with the pressed lemon juice and ice, the whiskies, and the bottle of Perrier water, he told me that the pharmacy was closed and he could not get a thermometer. He had borrowed some aspirin. I asked him to see if he could borrow a thermometer. Scott opened his eyes and gave a baleful Irish look at the waiter.
"Have you told him how serious it is?" he asked.
"I think he understands.
Please try to make it clear."
I tried to make it clear, and the waiter said, "I'll bring what I can."
"Did you tip him enough to do any good? They only work for tips."
"I didn't know that," I said. "I thought the hotel paid them something on the side."
"I mean they will only do something for you for a substantial tip. Most of them are rotten clean through."
I thought of Evan Shipman, and I thought of the waiter at the Closerie des Lilas, who had been forced to cut his mustache when they made the American bar at the Closerie, and how Evan had been working out at his garden in Montrouge long before I had met Scott, and what good friends we all were, and had been for a long time at the Lilas, and of all the moves that had been made and what they meant to all of us. I thought of telling Scott about this whole problem of the Lila, although I had probably mentioned it to him before, but I knew he did not care about waiters, nor their problems, nor their great kindnesses and affections. At that time, Scott hated the French, and since almost the only French he met with regularly were waiters whom he did not understand, taxi drivers, garage employees, and landlords, he had many opportunities to insult and abuse them. He hated the Italians even more than the French, and could not talk about them calmly, even when he was sober. The English he often hated, but he sometimes tolerated them, and occasionally looked up to them. I did not know how he felt about the Germans and the Austrians. I did not know whether he had ever met any then, or any Swiss. On this evening in the hotel, I was delighted that he was being so calm.
I had mixed the lemonade and whiskey and given it to him with two aspirins, and he had swallowed the aspirins without protest and with admirable calm, and was sipping his drink. His eyes were open now and were looking far away. I was reading the cream in the inside of the paper and was quite happy. Too happy, it seemed.
"You're a cold one, aren't you?" Scott asked, and looking at him I saw that I had been wrong in my prescription, if not in my diagnosis, and that the whiskey was working against us.
"How do you mean, Scott?"
"You could sit there and read that dirty French rag of a paper, and it doesn't mean a thing to you that I am dying."
"Do you want me to call a doctor?"
"No, I don't want a dirty French provincial doctor."
"What do you want?"
"I want my temperature taken. Then I want my clothes dried and for us to get on an express train for Paris and to go to the American hospital at Neuilly."
"Our clothes won't be dry until morning and there aren't any express trains," I said. "Why don't you rest and have some dinner in bed?"
"I want my temperature taken."
After this went on for a long time, the waiter brought a thermometer.
"Is this the only one you could get?" I asked.
Scott had shut his eyes when the waiter came in, and he did look at least as far gone as Camille. I have never seen a man who lost the blood from his face so fast, and I wondered where it went. "It's the only one in the hotel," the waiter said, and handed me the thermometer. It was a bath thermometer with a wooden back and enough metal to sink it in the bath. I took a quick gulp of the whiskey sour and opened the window a moment to look out at the rain. When I turned, Scott was watching me. I shook the thermometer down professionally and said, "You're lucky it's not a rectal thermometer."
"Where does this kind go?"
"Under the arm," I told him, and tucked it under my arm.
"Don't upset the temperature," Scott said.
I shook the thermometer again with a single sharp downward twitch and unbuttoned his pajama jacket and put the instrument under his armpit while I felt his cool forehead and then took his pulse. He stared straight ahead. The pulse was 72. I kept the thermometer in for 4 minutes.
"I thought they only kept them in for 1 minute," Scott said.
"This is a big thermometer," I explained. "You multiply by the square of the size of the thermometer. It's a centigrade thermometer." Finally, I took the thermometer out and carried it over by the reading light.
"What is it?"
37 6/10.
"What's normal?"
"That's normal."
"Are you sure?"
"Sure."
"Try it on yourself. I have to be sure."
I shook the thermometer down and opened my pajamas and put the thermometer in my armpit and held it there while I watched the time. Then I looked at it.
"What is it?"
I studied it. Exactly the same.
"How do you feel?"
"Splendid," I said. I was trying to remember whether 37.6 was really normal or not. It did not matter, for the thermometer, unaffected, was steady at 30. Scott was a little suspicious, so I asked if he wanted me to make another test.
"No," he said. "We can be happy it cleared up so quickly. I've always had great recuperative power."
"You're fine," I said. "But I think it would be just as well if you stayed in bed and had a light supper, and then we can start early in the morning." I had planned to buy us raincoats, but I would have to borrow money from him for that, and I did not want to start arguing about that now. Scott did not want to stay in bed. He wanted to get up and get dressed and go downstairs and call Zelda so she would know he was all right. Why would she think you weren't all right? This is the first night I have ever slept away from her since we were married and I have to talk to her. You can see what it means to us both, can't you? I could, but I could not see how he and Zelda could have slept together on the night just past. But it was nothing to argue about. Scott drank the whiskey sour down very fast now and asked me to order another. I found the waiter and returned the thermometer and asked him how our clothes were coming along. He thought they might be dry in an hour or so. Have the valet press them and that will dry them. It doesn't matter that they should be bone dry.
The waiter brought the two drinks against catching cold, and I sipped mine and urged Scott to sip his slowly. I was worried now he might catch cold, and I could see by now that if he ever had anything as definitely bad as a cold, he would probably have to be hospitalized. But the drink made him feel wonderful for a while, and he was happy with the tragic implications of this being Zelda's and his first night of separation since their marriage. Finally, he could not wait longer to call her, and put on his dressing gown and went down to put the call through. It would take some time for the call, and shortly after he came up, the waiter appeared with two more double whiskey sours. This was the most I had ever seen Scott drink until then, but they had no effect on him except to make him more animated and talkative, and he started to tell me the outline of his life with Zelda. He told me how he had first met her during the war, and then lost her and won her back, and about their marriage, and then about something tragic that had happened to them at San Rafael about a year ago. This first version that he told me of Zelda and a French naval aviator falling in love was a truly sad story, and I believe it was a true story. Later he told me other versions of it, as though trying them for use in a novel, but none was as sad as this first one, and I always believed the first one, although any of them might have been true. They were better told each time, but they never hurt you the same way the first one did. Scott was very articulate and told a story well. He did not have to spell the words nor attempt to punctuate, and you did not have the feeling of reading an illiterate that his letters gave you before they had been corrected. I knew him for 2 years before he could spell my name, but then it was a long name to spell, and perhaps it became harder to spell all of the time, and I give him great credit for spelling it correctly finally. He learned to spell many more important things, and he tried to think straight about many more. On this night, though, he wanted me to know and understand and appreciate what it was that had happened at San Rafael, and I saw it so clearly that I could see the single-seater seaplane buzzing the diving raft, and the color of the sea, and the shape of the pontoons, and the shadow that they cast, and Zelda's tan, and Scott's tan, and the dark blonde and the light blonde of their hair, and the darkly tanned face of the boy that was in love with Zelda. I could not ask the question that was in my mind, how, if the story was true and it had all happened, could Scott have slept each night in the same bed with Zelda? But maybe that was what had made it sadder than any story anyone had ever told me then. And, too, maybe he did not remember, as he did not remember last night. Our clothes came before the call did, and we dressed and went downstairs to have dinner. Scott was a little unsteady now, and he looked at people out of the side of his eyes with a certain belligerency. We had very good snails, with a carafe of Fleury to start with, and while we were about halfway through them, Scott's call came. He was gone about an hour, and I ate his snails finally, dipping up the butter, garlic, and parsley sauce with broken bits of bread, and drank the carafe of Fleury. When he came back, I said I would get him some more snails, but he said he did not want any. He wanted something simple. He did not want a steak, nor liver and bacon, nor an omelet. He would take chicken. We had eaten very good cold chicken at noon, but this was still famous chicken country, so we had poulard de Bresse and a bottle of Montigny, a light, pleasant white wine of the neighborhood. Scott ate very little and sipped at one glass of the wine. He passed out at the table with his head on his hands. It was natural, and there was no theater about it, and it even looked as though he were careful not to spill nor break things. The waiter and I got him up to his room and laid him on the bed, and I undressed him to his underwear, hung his clothes up, and then stripped the covers off the bed and spread them over him. I opened the window and saw it was clear outside, and left the window open. Downstairs, I finished my dinner and thought about Scott. It was obvious he should not drink anything, and I had not been taking good care of him. Anything that he drank seemed to stimulate him too much, and then to poison him, and I planned on the next day to cut all drinking to the minimum. I would tell him that we were getting back to Paris now, and that I had to train in order to write. This was not true. My training was never to drink after dinner, nor before I wrote, nor while I was writing. But I went upstairs and opened all the windows wide, and undressed and was asleep almost as soon as I was in bed. The next day we drove to Paris on a beautiful day up through the Côte d'Or, with the air freshly washed and the hills and the fields and the vineyards all new. And Scott was very cheerful and happy and healthy, and told me the plots of each and every one of Michael Arlen's books. Michael Arlen, he said, was the man you had to watch, and he and I could both learn much from him. I said I could not read the books. He said I did not have to. He would tell me the plots and describe the characters. He gave me a sort of oral Ph.D. thesis on Michael Arlen. I asked him if he had a good connection on the phone when he talked to Zelda, and he said that it was not bad, and that they had many things to talk about. At meals, I ordered one bottle of the lightest wine I could locate, and told Scott he would do me a great favor if he would not let me order any more, as I had to train before I wrote, and should not under any circumstances drink more than half a bottle. He cooperated wonderfully, and when he saw me looking nervous toward the end of a single bottle, gave me some of his share. When I had left him at his home and taken a taxi back to the sawmill, it was wonderful to see my wife, and we went up to the Closerie des Lilas to have a drink. We were happy the way children are, who have been separated and are together again, and I told her about the trip. "But didn't you have any fun or learn anything, Tati?" she asked. I learned about Michael Arlen, if I would have listened, and I learned things I haven't sorted out. Isn't Scott happy at all? Maybe. Poor man. I learned one thing.
What?
Never go on trips with anyone you do not love.
Isn't that fine?
Yes, and we're going to Spain.
Yes, now it's less than 6 weeks before we go. And this year we won't let anyone spoil it, will we?
No. And after Pamplona we'll go to Madrid and to Valencia. She said softly, like a cat.
Poor Scott, I said.
Poor everybody. Hadley said. Rich feather cats with no money. We're awfully lucky. We'll have to be good and hold it.
We both touched wood on the cafe table, and the waiter came to see what it was we wanted. But what we wanted, not he, nor anyone else, nor knocking on wood, nor on marble, as this cafe tabletop was, could ever bring us. But we did not know it that night. And we were very happy. A day or two after the trip, Scott brought his book over. It had a garish dust jacket, and I remember being embarrassed by the violence, bad taste, and slippery look of it. It looked, the book jacket, for a book of bad science fiction. Scott told me not to be put off by it, that it had to do with a billboard along a highway in Long Island that was important in the story. He said he had liked the jacket, and now he didn't like it. I took it off to read the book. When I had finished the book, I knew that no matter what Scott did, nor how preposterously he behaved, I must know it was like a sickness, and be of any help I could to him, and try to be a good friend. He had many good, good friends, more than anyone I knew, but I enlisted as one more, whether I could be of any use to him or not. If he could write a book as fine as The Great Gatsby, I was sure that he could write an even better one. I did not know Zelda yet, and so I did not know the terrible odds that were against him. But we were to find them out soon enough.
18. Hawks do not share. Scott Fitzgerald invited us to have lunch with his wife Zelda and his little daughter at the furnished flat they had rented at 14 Rue de Tilsit. I cannot remember much about the flat except that it was gloomy and airless, and that there was nothing in it that seemed to belong to them, except Scott's first books bound in light blue leather with the titles in gold. Scott also showed us a large ledger with all of the stories he had published listed in it year after year, with the prices he had received for them, and also the amounts received for any motion picture sales, and the sales and royalties of his books.
They were all noted as carefully as the log of a ship, and Scott showed them to both of us with impersonal pride as though he were the curator of a museum. Scott was nervous and hospitable, and he showed us his accounts of his earnings as though they had been the view. There was no view. Zelda had a very bad hangover. They had been up on Montmartre the night before and had quarreled because Scott did not want to get drunk. He had decided, he told me, to work hard and not to drink, and Zelda was treating him as though he were a killjoy or a spoil sport. Those were the two words she used to him, and there was recrimination, and Zelda would say,
"I did not. I did no such thing. It's not true, Scott."
Later she would seem to recall something and would laugh happily. On this day, Zelda did not look her best. Her beautiful dark blonde hair had been ruined temporarily by a bad permanence she had gotten in Lyon, where the rain had made them abandon their car, and her eyes were tired and her face was too taut and drawn. She was formerly pleasant to Hadley and me, but a big part of her seemed not to be present, but to be still on the party she had come home from that morning. She and Scott both seemed to feel that Scott and I enjoyed a great and wonderful time on the trip up from Lyon, and she was jealous about it.
"When you two can go off and have such simply wonderful times together, it only seems fair that I should have just a little fun with our good friends here in Paris," she said to Scott.
Scott was being the perfect host, and we ate a very bad lunch that the wine cheered a little but not much. The little girl was blonde, chubby-faced, well-built, and very healthy-looking, and spoke English with a strong Cockney accent. Scott explained that she had an English nanny because he wanted her to speak like Lady Diana Manners when she grew up. Zelda had hawk's eyes and a thin mouth and deep South manners and accent. Watching her face, you could see her mind leave the table and go to the night's party and return with her eyes blank as a cat's, and then pleased, and the pleasure would show along the thin line of her lips and then be gone. Scott was being the good, cheerful host, and Zelda looked at him, and she smiled happily with her eyes and her mouth, too, as he drank the wine. I learned to know that smile very well. It meant she knew Scott would not be able to write. Zelda was very jealous of Scott's work, and as we got to know them, this fell into a regular pattern. Scott would resolve not to go on all-night drinking parties and to get some exercise each day and work regularly. He would start to work, and as soon as he was working well, Zelda would begin complaining about how bored she was and get him off on another drunken party. They would quarrel and then make up, and he would sweat out the alcohol on long walks with me, and make up his mind that this time he would really work and would start off well. Then it would start all over again. Scott was very much in love with Zelda, and he was very jealous of her. He told me many times on our walks of how she had fallen in love with a French Navy pilot. He had told me the story very many times by now, starting on the trip, and it was his best story no matter how he told it. But she had never made him really jealous with another man since. This spring she was making him jealous with other women, and on the Montmartre parties he was afraid to pass out, and he was afraid to have her pass out. Becoming unconscious when they drank had always been their great defense. They went to sleep on drinking an amount of liquor or champagne that would have little effect on a person accustomed to drinking, and they would go to sleep like children. I have seen them become unconscious, not as though they were drunk, but as though they had been anesthetized, and their friends, or sometimes a taxi driver, would get them to bed. And when they woke, they would be fresh and happy, not having taken enough alcohol to damage their bodies before it made them unconscious. Now they had lost this natural defense. At this time, Zelda could drink more than Scott could, and Scott was afraid for her to pass out in the company they kept that spring and in the places they went to. Scott did not like the places, nor the people, and he had to drink more than he could drink and be in any control of himself to stand the people and the places. And then he began to have to drink to keep awake
after he would usually have passed out. Finally, he had few intervals of work at all. He was always trying to work. Each day he would try and fail. He laid the failure to Paris, the town best organized for a writer to write in that there is. And he thought always that there would be some place where he and Zelda could have a good life together again. He thought of the Riviera, as it was then before it had all been built up, with the lovely stretches of blue sea and the sand beaches, and the stretches of pine woods and the mountains of the Estoril going out into the sea. He remembered it as it was when he and Zelda had first found it before people went there for the summer. Scott told me about the Riviera and how my wife and I must come there the next summer, and how we would go there and how he would find a place for us that was not expensive, and we would both work hard every day and swim and lie on the beach and be brown and only have a single aperitif before lunch and one before dinner. Zelda would be happy there, he said. She loved to swim and was a beautiful diver, and she was happy with that life and would want him to work and everything would be wonderful. He and Zelda and their daughter were going to go there that summer. I was trying to get him to write his stories as well as he could, and not trick them to conform to any formula, as he had explained that he did. "You've written a fine novel now," I told him, "and you mustn't write slop." "The novel isn't selling," he said. "I must write stories, and they have to be stories that will sell." "Write the best story that you can, and write it as straight as you can." "I'm going to," he said. But the way things were going, he was lucky to get any work done at all. Zelda did not encourage the people who were chasing her, and she had nothing to do with them, she said. But it amused her, and it made Scott jealous, and he had to go with her to the places. It destroyed his work, and she was more jealous of his work than anything. All that late spring and early summer, Scott fought to work, but he could only work in snatches. When I saw him, he was always cheerful, sometimes desperately cheerful, and he made good jokes and was a good companion. When he had very bad times, I listened to him about them and tried to make him know that if he could hold on to himself, he would write as he was made to write, and that only death was irrevocable. He would make fun of himself then, and as long as he could do that, I thought that he was safe. Through all of this, he wrote one good story, The Rich Boy, and I was sure that he could write better than that as he did later. During the summer, we were in Spain, and I started the first draft of a novel and finished it back in Paris in September. Scott and Zelda had been at Cap d'Antibes, and that fall when I saw him in Paris, he was very changed. He had not done any sobering up on the Riviera, and he was drunk now in the daytime as well as nights. It did not make any difference anymore to him that anyone was working, and he would come to 113 Rue Notre-Dame des Champs any time he was drunk, either in the daytime or at night. He had begun to be very rude to his inferiors or anyone he considered his inferior. One time he came in through the sawmill gate with his small daughter. It was the English nurse's day off, and Scott was caring for the child, and at the foot of the stairs she told him she needed to go to bathroom. Scott started to undress her, and the proprietor, who lived on the floor below us, came in and said very politely, "Monsieur, there is a cabinet de toilette just ahead of you to the left of the stairs." "Yes, and I'll put your head in it too if you're not too careful," Scott told him. He was very difficult all that fall, but he had begun to work on a novel when he was sober. I saw him rarely when he was sober, but when he was sober, he was always pleasant, and he still made jokes, and sometimes he would still make jokes about himself. But when he was drunk, he would usually come to find me, and drunk, he took almost as much pleasure interfering with my work as Zelda did interfering with his. This continued for years, but for years too, I had no more loyal friend than Scott when he was sober. That fall of 1925, he was upset because I would not show him the manuscript of the first draft of The Sun Also Rises. I explained to him that it would mean nothing until I had gone over it and rewritten it, and that I did not want to discuss it or show it to anyone first.
We were going down to Schruns in the Vorarlberg in Austria as soon as the first snowfall there. I rewrote the first half of the manuscript there, finishing it in January, I think. I took it to New York and showed it to Max Perkins of Scribner's, and then went back to Schruns and finished rewriting the book. Scott did not see it until after the completed rewritten and cut manuscript had been sent to Scribner's at the end of April. I do not remember when I showed finished things to him first that year, nor when he first saw the proofs on the rewritten and cut version. We discussed them, but I made the decisions. Not that it matters. I remember joking with him about them and him being worried and anxious to help, as always, once a thing was done. But I did not want his help while I was trying to do it. While we were living in the Vorarlberg and I was finishing rewriting the novel, Scott and his wife and child had left Paris for a watering place in the Lower Pyrenees. Zelda had been ill with that familiar intestinal complaint that too much champagne produces, and which was then diagnosed as colitis. Scott was not drinking and starting to work, and he wanted us, really, to come to Juan-les-Pins in June. They would find an inexpensive villa for us, and this time he would not drink, and it would be like the old good days, and we would swim and be healthy and brown, and have one aperitif before lunch and one before dinner. Zelda was well again, and they were both fine, and his novel was going wonderfully. He had money coming in from a dramatization of The Great Gatsby, which was running well, and it would sell to the movies, and he had no worries. Zelda was really fine, and everything was going to be wonderful. I had been down in Madrid in May, working by myself, and I came by train from Bayonne to Juan-les-Pins, third class, and quite hungry, because I had run out of money stupidly and had eaten last an Andée at the French-Spanish frontier. It was a nice villa, and Scott had a very fine house not far away, and I was very happy to see my wife, who had the villa running beautifully, and our friends, and the single aperitif before lunch was very good, and we had several more. That night there was a party to welcome us at the casino, just a small party, the MacLeishes, the Murphys, the Fitzgeralds, and we who were living at the villa. No one drank anything stronger than champagne, and it was very gay and obviously a splendid place to write. It was going to be everything that a man needed to write, except to be alone. Zelda was very beautiful, and was tanned a lovely gold color, and her hair was a beautiful dark gold, and she was very friendly. Her hawk's eyes were clear and calm. I knew everything was all right, and was going to turn out well in the end, when she leaned forward and said to me, telling me her great secret,
"Ernest, don't you think Al Jolson is greater than Jesus?"
Nobody except Pauline thought anything of it at the time. It was only Zelda's secret that she shared with me, as a hawk might share something with a man. But hawks do not share. Scott did not write anything any more that was good until after he knew that she was insane. 19. A Matter of Measurements. Once, much later, in the time after Zelda had what was then called her first nervous breakdown, and we happened to be in Paris at the same time, Scott asked me to have lunch with him at Michaud's restaurant on the corner of the Rue Jacob and the Rue des Saints-Pères. He said he had something very important to ask me that meant more than anything in the world to him, and that I must answer him absolutely truly. I said that I would do the best that I could. For a long time, when he would ask me to tell him something absolutely truly, which is very difficult to do, and I would try it, the thing that I would say would make him angry. Often not when I said it, but afterwards, and sometimes long afterwards when he had brooded on it, and it would be something that would have to be destroyed, and sometimes, if possible, me with it. He drank wine at the lunch, but it did not affect him, and he had not prepared for the lunch by drinking before it. We talked about our work and about people, and he asked me about people that we had been out of touch with. I knew that he was writing something good, and that he was having great trouble with it, for many reasons, but that was not what he wanted to talk about.
I kept waiting for it to come, the thing that I had to tell the absolute truth about. But he would not bring it up until the end of the meal, as though we were having a business lunch. Finally, when we were eating the cherry tart and had a last carafe of wine, he said, "You know I never slept with anyone except Zelda."
"No, I didn't."
"I thought I had told you."
"No, you told me a lot of things, but not that."
"That is what I have to ask you about."
"Good. Go on."
"Zelda said that the way I was built, I could never make any woman happy, and that was what upset her originally. She said it was a matter of measurements. I have never felt the same since she said that, and I have to know truly."
"Come out to the office," I said. "Or you go out first."
"Where is the office?"
"La Water," I said. We came back into the room and sat down at the table. "You're perfectly fine," I said. "You are okay. There's nothing wrong with you. You look at yourself from above, and you look foreshortened. Go over to the Louvre and look at the people in the statues, then go home and look at yourself in the mirror in profile."
"Those statues may not be accurate."
"They are pretty good. Most people would settle for them."
"But why would she say it?"
"To put you out of business. That's the oldest way of putting people out of business in the world. Scott, you asked me to tell you the truth, and I can tell you a lot more, but this is the absolute truth and all you need. You could have gone to see a doctor."
"I didn't want to. I wanted you to tell me truly."
"Now do you believe me?"
"I don't know," he said.
"Come on over to the Louvre," I said. "It's just down the street and across the river." We went over to the Louvre, and he looked at the statues, but still he was doubtful about himself. "It's not basically a question of the size in repose," I said. "It is the size that it becomes. It is also a question of angle." I explained to him about using a pillow and a few other things that might be useful for him to know.
"There is one girl," he said, "who has been very nice to me. But after what Zelda said..."
"Forget what Zelda said," I told him. "Zelda is crazy. There's nothing wrong with you. Just have confidence and do what the girl wants. Zelda just wants to destroy you."
"You don't know anything about Zelda."
"All right," I said. "Let it go at that. But you came to lunch to ask me a question, and I've tried to give you an honest answer." But he was still doubtful. "Should we go and see some pictures?" I asked. "Have you ever seen anything in here except the Mona Lisa?"
"I'm not in the mood for looking at pictures," he said. "I promised to meet some people at the Ritz Bar."
Many years later, at the Ritz Bar, long after the end of World War II, Georges, who is the barman now and who was the chasseur when Scott lived in Paris, asked me, "Papa, who was this Monsieur Fitzgerald that everyone asks me about?"
"Didn't you know him?"
"No. I remember all of the people of that time. But now they ask me only about him."
"What do you tell them?"
"Anything interesting that they wish to hear. What will please them?"
"What do you wish?"
"But tell me, who was he?" "He was an American writer of the early 20s and later, who lived some time in Paris and abroad."
"But why would I not remember him? Was he a good writer?"
"He wrote 2 very good books, and 1 which was not completed, which those who know his writing best say would have been very good. He also wrote some good short stories."
"Did he frequent the bar much?"
"I believe so."
"But you did not come to the bar in the early 20s. I know that you were poor then and lived in a different quarter."
"When I had money, I went to the Crillon."
"I know that, too. I remember very well when we first met."
"So do I."
"It is strange that I have no memory of him," Georges said.
"All those people are dead."
"Still, one does not forget people because they are dead, and people keep asking me about him. You must tell me something about him for my memoirs."
"I will." "I remember you and the Baron von Blixen arriving one night.
In what year?"
He smiled. "He is dead, too."
"Yes, but one does not forget him. You see what I mean?"
His first wife wrote very beautifully, I said. She wrote perhaps the best book about Africa that I ever read, except Sir Samuel Baker's book on the Nile tributaries of Abyssinia. Put that in your memoirs, since you are interested in writers now.
Good, said Georges. The Baron was not a man that you forget.
And the name of the book?
Out of Africa, I said. Blicky was always very proud of his first wife's writing, but we knew each other long before she had written that book.
But Monsieur Fitzgerald that they keep asking me about.
He was in Frank's time.
Yes, but I was the chasseur. You know what a chasseur is.
I am going to write something about him in a book that I will write about the early days in Paris. I promised myself that I would write it.
Good, said Georges.
I will put him in exactly as I remember him the first time that I met him.
Good, said Georges.
Then if he came here, I will remember him. After all, one does not forget people.
Tourists?
Naturally.
But you say he came here very much?
It meant very much to him.
You write about him as you remember him, and then if he came here, I will remember him.
We will see, I said.
Additional Paris sketches. Birth of a new school. The blue-backed notebooks, the two pencils and the pencil sharpener, a pocket knife was too wasteful. The marble top tables, the smell of café crème, the smell of early morning sweeping out and mopping and luck were all you needed. For luck, you carried a horse chestnut and a rabbit's foot in your right pocket. The fur had been worn off the rabbit's foot long ago, and the bones and the sinews were polished by wear. The claws scratched in the lining of your pocket, and you knew your luck was still there. Some days it went so well that you could make the country so that you could walk into it through the timber to come out into the clearing and onto the high ground and see the hills beyond the arm of the lake. A pencil lead might break off in the conical nose of the pencil sharpener, and you would use the small blade of the penknife to clear it, or else sharpen the pencil carefully with the sharp blade, and then slip your arm through the sweat-salted leather of your pack strap to lift the pack again, get the other arm through and feel the weight settle on your back, and feel the pine needles under your moccasins as you started down for the lake. Then you would hear someone say, "Hi, Hem, what are you trying to do, write in a cafe?" Your luck had run out, and you shut the notebook. This was the worst thing that could happen. If you could keep your temper, it would be better, but I was not good at keeping mine then, and said, "You rotten son of a bitch, what are you doing here off your filthy beat?
Don't be insulting just because you want to act like an eccentric.
Take your dirty camping mouth out of here.
It's a public cafe. I've just as much right here as you have.
Why don't you go up to the Petite Chaumière where you belong?"
"Oh, dear, don't be so tiresome."
Now you could get out and hope it was an accidental visit and that the visitor had only come in by chance and there was not going to be an infestation. There were other good cafes to work in, but they were a long walk away and this was your home cafe. It was bad to be driven out of the Closerie des Lilas. You had to make a stand or move. It was probably wiser to move, but the anger started to come, and I said, "Listen, a bitch like you has plenty of places to go. Why do you have to come here and louse a decent cafe?"
"I just came in to have a drink. What's wrong with that?"
"At home, they'd serve you and then break the glass."
"Where's home? It sounds like a charming place."
He was sitting at the next table, a tall, fat young man with spectacles. He had ordered a beer. I thought I would ignore him and see if I could write, so I ignored him and wrote two sentences.
"All I did was speak to you."
I went on and wrote another sentence. It dies hard when it really is going, and you are into it.
"I suppose you've gotten so great nobody can speak to you."
I wrote another sentence that ended the paragraph and read it over. It was still all right, and I wrote the first sentence of the next paragraph.
"You never think about anyone else or that they may have problems, too."
I had heard complaining all my life. I found I could go on writing and that it was no worse than other noises, certainly better than Ezra learning to play the bassoon.
Suppose you wanted to be a writer and feel it in every part of your body, and it just wouldn't come.
I went on writing, and I was beginning to have luck now as well as the other thing.
Suppose once it had come like an irresistible torrent, and then it left.